Greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, February 10th, 2020 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, then I'll read the cover story, Points of Progress, Science and Nature, Home Forum, and the Monitor's View. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled, Replacing Despair with Hope in Rural America. This is written by Mark Sappenfield, the editor, and you can reach Mark at editor@csmonitor.com. And he writes, As regular readers will know, I occasionally use this space to acquaint you with thinkers and readers who embody the Monitor spirit. So this week brought a dilemma. Discuss Krista Case Bryant's wonderful cover story, or share my conversation with two of the most remarkable journalists of our lifetimes. In the end, I'll let you enjoy Krista's cover story about Estonia's efforts to foil Russian interference on your own. At its heart, it's about how true alertness is not in alarm or disquiet, but rather is the natural outgrowth of communal purpose. And Estonia shows us how powerful that can be. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun, for their parts, have shown the world how powerful journalism can be. The married couple won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the 1989 democracy protests in China. Then Mr. Kristof won another for his coverage of the Darfur genocide in Sudan. But what matters far more is the good their journalism has done. Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa affectionately called Mr. Kristof an honorary African for his role in alleviating suffering on the continent. Last month, I interviewed them about their new book, Tightrope, which is reviewed on page 41. That same desire to help and heal pours from its pages. They profile the rural Oregon town where Mr. Kristof grew up and examine with heartbreaking intimacy why so many of his childhood friends have turned to drugs and crime, falling into poverty and dying early. It is a compassionate look at the rural anger and despair that has provided essential fuel for the rise of President Donald Trump. Yet the book isn't about politics. It is about hope, the deep yearning for it in places like Yamhill, Oregon, and how the country might rekindle it. And here's the couple's conclusion. By making our own government an enemy during the past 50 years, Americans have handcuffed one of the most effective ways to spread opportunity, and the hope that comes with it, to those who feel it is lost. To some readers, Tightrope might seem like a hymn to big government, but I don't think it is. It says we are spending too much money on the back end, prisons and healthcare, because we don't spend enough money on the front end, education and child development. More than that, it probes what government actually is. In one poignant passage, it speaks of how Canadian authorities rushed in to help those hurt by General Motors plant closures, while American authorities did little. What sense of community and caring does that convey? The proof is in the outcomes, where America lags most other developed nations on a host of social indexes. Allowing millions of fellow Americans to fall into poverty and despair is not inevitable, Mr. Kristof and Ms. Wudun argue. It is a choice. Whether in America or Estonia, a broad and deep sense of community can do the seemingly impossible. You can listen to the audio interview with Mr. Kristof and Ms. Wudun online at www.csmonitor.com/tightrope. And that was the From the Editor column written by Mark Sappenfield, the editor. And this week it was entitled Replacing Despair with Hope in Rural America. And now for the cover story. This week it's entitled Estonia's Cyber Warriors. How the tiny Baltic state has become a model in foiling Russian hacking and disinformation. And this is written by Krista Case Bryant, a staff writer. There's a paragraph here that says why we wrote this. Evidence exists that Russian hackers penetrated voting systems in all 50 U.S. states during the 2016 election. Now, as 2020 voting begins, Estonia offers lessons on how to avoid such breaches, enlisting everyone from IT nerds to grandparents. All right, the article is from Tallinn and Narva, Estonia. If a modern-day Paul Revere were to gallop through cyberspace yelling, "The Russians are coming," John Prisalu would be among the first to jump to the rescue. A taciturn information technology expert who seems to make some of his best decisions in the sauna, Mr. Prisalu is no stranger to battling Russian cyber warriors. When Russian hackers were believed to carry out the world's first politically motivated cyber attack against a nation in 2007, leaving large parts of Estonian society electronically dark, Mr. Prisalu was in charge of IT risk management at the country's leading bank. Today, he is a researcher at Tallinn University of Technology. On a dreary November day, he is sitting in his office in red polka dot socks and slippers when the phone rings. It is Andras Padar, commander of Estonia's Cyber Defense League, asking if he could join in an exercise this week. With a shoestring budget of about $300,000 to cover office space and a few staff members, Mr. Padar depends on hundreds of volunteers like Mr. Prisalu, who are willing to spend their evenings and weekends bolstering the country's cyber defenses. They do everything from giving talks at elementary schools to planning elaborate simulated cyber crises so government officials can refine the response skills. These volunteers are affectionately dubbed the Nerd Reserves and come mainly from the vibrant IT community in Estonia, which developed the original software behind Skype. But they also include teachers, lawyers, utility employees, even a man of the cloth. They fight for free, basically, and that's the beauty of doing it free will, says Avar Serapik, an Estonian Orthodox priest who has served as chaplain for the unit since its inception. You protect your lifestyle, you protect your value system, you protect who you are. These are modern-day Minutemen of Estonia. They're part of a broader electronic bulwark this Baltic nation has built since the 2007 attacks, which were a prototype of the 21st century conflict that Russia has since refined and deployed in numerous Western democracies. With the help of everyone, from academics to ambassadors, military officers to election officials, Estonia has merged or emerged as a model for other countries keen to counter Moscow's meddling. According to experts here and in Washington, Russia aims to undermine Western democracies both to boost its own global standing and to thwart democratic aspirations at home. It tries to do this by sowing doubt about democracy, undermining public trust in democratic leaders and institutions, and dividing nations and alliances. The foreign intruders have proved they can infiltrate everything from voting lists to banking systems and personal laptops. The adversary, looking to delegitimize or create fear, confusion, and doubt about our societies, is working across the globe, and we know that they're not shy about recycling effective methods, says Lisa Past, Chief National Cyber Risk Officer for Estonia's National Security and Defense Coordination Unit. As the U.S. heads into the 2020 election, looking to better protect itself against the Russian interference that roiled the country 4 years ago, Estonia offers key lessons. This tiny country on the fringes of Russia has become known around the world for both its cybersecurity expertise and secure online voting system. But its greatest defenses may not be technical at all. They lie in a way of thinking, a shared understanding that erecting a protective cyber wall requires alertness, but not alarmism, as well as an urgency and unity of purpose that impel coordination across diverse sectors. The lessons we learned from 2007 can apply to all countries, irrespective of size, says Marina Kaljuran, an Estonian cybersecurity expert and former ambassador to the United States, now serving in the European Parliament. For the U.S., my suggestion would be not to wait until a cyber 911, but to come together much earlier. On a spring evening in 2007, Heli Tirma Klar had finally just gotten her children to bed around 11 p.m. when the phone rang. It was one of her husband's colleagues who demanded that she wake him up. There was a water cannon, used for riot control, standing in front of their European Commission office downtown, he said. "You are dreaming," she recalls telling him. The capital had been quiet since Estonia regained its independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. But sure enough, protesters were smashing store windows, setting fires, and chanting, "Russia, Russia, Russia." Most of them were from Estonia's sizable ethnic Russian minority and were upset by the Estonian government's decision to move a controversial Soviet-era monument, known as the Bronze Soldier, from a prominent location downtown to a military cemetery not far away. The larger backdrop was growing tension between a resurgent Russia under President Vladimir Putin and NATO, which, thanks to Estonia's admittance as a member 3 years earlier, now had a presence on Russia's doorstep. At first, the protests appeared to be a spontaneous outburst by local youths. But shortly thereafter, a wave of coordinated cyber attacks disabled government websites, newspapers, and banks. Estonians quickly became convinced that Russia was behind the digital assaults, especially when Russian law enforcement authorities refused to cooperate with their Estonian counterparts in identifying the culprits. We decided we just have to become much more resilient and make sure, in case something similar happens again, that we will be ready, says Ms. Tirmar Klar, Estonia's ambassador at large for cyber diplomacy, who was then at the Ministry of Defense. Estonians are well aware of Moscow's attempts to manipulate and deceive them. As Soviet citizens, they were subjected to everything from TV broadcasts full of propaganda to more covert shenanigans. Estonians have a museum in an upscale hotel in Tallinn that shows, among other things, how the KGB famously embedded listening devices in plates at the hotel restaurant. We have 60 years of experience in reading between the lines and speaking between the lines, says Tonu Tammer, head of the Computer Emergency Response Team at the Estonian Information System Authority. It's actually our dear adversaries that keep those skills honed for the younger generation. Social media and the internet have opened new ways for Russia to infiltrate networks and disseminate disinformation with vastly more speed and scope. U.S. intelligence agencies have blamed a Russian cyber espionage team for penetrating the computer networks of the Democratic National Committee in the run-up to the 2016 American presidential election. Later, Russian hackers gained access to thousands of private emails of Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta. More broadly, U.S. investigators have found evidence of Russian intrusion in election systems in all 50 states, even though voting seemed to be largely unaffected in most areas. Russia is also the prime suspect behind one of the costliest cyber attacks, NotPetya, which targeted Ukraine in 2017 and then spread to 64 countries, causing an estimated $10 billion in damage. Estonia, however, was virtually untouched by this attack. Across society, from Mr. Pyotr's volunteer cyber defense league to grandparents being taught to use more complicated passwords, the country has honed a robust civilian and government network to protect the young democracy against foreign intrusion. It has also helped bolster its neighbors, in part because of an idea for joint cyber exercises hatched in one of Mr. Prisalu's sauna sessions with a couple of Swedes. Several years after 9-1-1, when Estonia joined NATO, it proposed hosting a NATO Center of Excellence for Cyber Defense. The initial response from other members? Cyber? We're in the middle of helping to fight a war in Afghanistan. Plus, there was doubt that tiny Estonia could be of much help. But after the 2007 attacks, NATO agreed to back the initiative. Do we lack people and resources? Yes. We're a country of 1.3 million people, says Colonel Jack Terrian, who today oversees the NATO Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence, or the CCD-COE, in Tallinn. But, he says, 2007 made people realize that it is important, and maybe Estonians know what they're doing. Today, the CCD-COE hosts the largest live-fire cyber defense exercise in the world. Known as Locked Shields, the annual drill draws more than 1,200 participants from nearly 30 countries. Last April, the scenario involved a coordinated series of cyber attacks during a national election, seeking to manipulate how the public perceived the election results and also affecting vital services. The exercise provided strategic decision makers and technical experts the opportunity to learn to work more closely in a time of crisis. Although Estonia itself hasn't faced a major attack on its voting system, it has been vigilant in defending its electoral machinery. The government offers free cybersecurity screenings for political parties and trains candidates how to recognize and avoid breaches. Estonian security specialists tried to break into the country's voting system about a year ahead of elections, and any vulnerabilities that are discovered are reported to the public, along with what's being done to fix them. Thanks in part to the heightened trust such transparency affords, more than 40% of Estonians now vote online. That's made possible by a system created in the 1990s, which gives each citizen a unique digital identification. A smart ID card with a chip, together with personal identification numbers, acts as a double authentication system that has enabled Estonia to offer nearly all government services online. New parents can order birth certificates from their laptops or access their children's school system. Parties can sign contracts, and patients' medical prescriptions are issued electronically. When a security lapse was discovered in the country's digital ID card system, the NERD reserves were brought in to help, demonstrating the practical assistance that goes along with their efforts to raise awareness among citizens and officials alike. It's very important that we not only don't scare them, we must also offer solutions, says Mr. Paydar. To bolster the country's electronic security, the NERD reserves stage exercises similar to the NATO cyber defense centers. In one drill, members of the government's cabinet confronted a Chernobyl-like disaster. They were told that sensors along the eastern border with Russia flashed readings showing a rapid rise in nuclear radiation, ostensibly due to a Russian nuclear plant malfunction. Unknown to the participants, however, there was no radiation. Instead, a cyber attack had relayed the false readings. The purpose was to create a mess, and the government need to think through what to do, says Mr. Potter. At one point during the exercise, cameras that were allowing outside observers to watch the cabinet members' response were shut off by the government security service. Was that part of the drill, or because officials didn't want details of the exercise to get out? I can't tell you more, says Mr. Prisalu. Cryptically. In December 2018, a story circulated on Russian social media with the hashtag #ESTEXITEU. It purported to show someone beating up an ethnic Russian in the Estonian capital. The attack supposedly took place in a district of Tallinn called Lasnamäe, which is home to 150,000 ethnic Russians. The implication was clear. The Russian-speaking minority in Estonia isn't safe. But a propaganda watchdog group called Propostop found the posts suspicious. One volunteer, who didn't want to be named for security reasons, sat on his couch night after night after his children had gone to bed to track down the story's origins. Through his and other people's efforts, Propostop revealed that there was more snow in the photo than there had been on the ground the day of the alleged beating, implying the location or date or both were fabricated. Propostop and investigative journalists Holger Runema and Martin Lane also found that the people running the accounts on Facebook and Vkontakte, a popular social media site in Russia, were using fake names and profile pictures. Presented with this evidence, Facebook shut down numerous accounts by mid-January, but the Vkontakte groups are still open. You can't do anything, just observe, says the volunteer. This is another way the Russians try to meddle, not only in Estonia, but in the U.S. as well, spreading disinformation. In fact, America is likely even more vulnerable to this type of manipulation than cyber attacks, and it's an area where Estonians, who lived for decades under Soviet occupation, may have the most to teach Americans. In the U.S., Russia has sought to exploit ideological divisions between Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, inciting heated conversations on Twitter or Facebook from a troll factory in St. Petersburg. The trolls focus on hot-button issues such as immigration or racism, the latter of which constituted some two-thirds of fake Russian account activity around the 2016 election. They perform their dark arts not so much through the blunt instrument of propaganda, as in the Soviet days, but much more subtly through fake social media accounts that often appeared sympathetic to popular causes, such as Black Lives Matter. In Estonia, by contrast, Russia seeks to exploit ethnic divisions, but the tactics are the same, trying to divide from within. In 2014, after Russia annexed Crimea, an area of Ukraine with an ethnic Russian majority, many outsiders looked at Estonia's eastern flank with its high concentration of ethnic Russians and wondered if it would be next. But even Sven Sakov, director of International Center for Defense and Security, ICDS, in Tallinn, says Estonia is not easy prey for Russian propaganda. For us, Russian information campaigns and for information warfare, influence operations, fake news is not something that just happened in 2014, he says, noting that because of its long history with such interference, the country is now quite well inoculated. There is one possible exception, though. Lasame, Dmitry Teperik, who studies national resilience in the face of hostile foreign influence activities at ICDS, estimates that while only 7-9% of Estonian society could be destabilized on ethnic and linguistic grounds, it's enough to create trouble. Even small groups can dictate some general or major shifts in society, especially if these minor groups are backed or supported by foreign actors, says Mr. Teperik, a Russian-speaking Estonian who co-founded a non-governmental organization designed to increase ethnic Russians' enlistment in the military. The gunpowder is definitely here. What we are missing, fortunately, is the spark. In 2018, Estonia's government office started a strategic communications team, which monitors the three main Russian TV channels as well as online media, and last year hosted an inaugural Media Literacy Week. Students in Estonian-speaking high schools all take a required 35-hour media and manipulation class. Strategic communication advisor Siim Kampas says that efforts are underway to extend the class to Russian language schools as well. The state electoral office is also involved, running a working group that needs daily duration election campaigns to monitor media and identify any attempts to influence elections through disinformation. In a media climate with several Russian language outlets that are considered propaganda machines, Estonia has allowed them to continue to operate, but has refused to give their reporters access to certain government events and high-level officials. Estonian authorities would also like to see social media platforms better regulate political ads. If citizens don't know who is whispering in their ear, then you don't have a genuine political discussion, but you have this postmodernist hodgepodge of yelling out loud, says Mr. Past, the government's chief national cyber risk officer. Ever since the late 18th century, we have put all our effort into building a society that is better than that, she says, referring to Western democracies. The question still looms. To what extent are these efforts applicable to the U.S.? Some, such as implementing a unified education curriculum similar to Estonia's, with its media and manipulation class, wouldn't be easy. It would require the buy-in of 50 states and thousands of local school boards, says Brett Schaefer, social media analyst for the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund in Washington, who has visited Estonia twice. Similarly, protecting election machinery against cyber attacks the way Estonians do would be difficult. Estonia has one unified state electoral office. The U.S. puts decisions about voting machines and methods in the hands of thousands of state and local officials. I'm not sure our country's model can immediately be imported, says Merle Magri, executive vice president of government relations at CybExer, an Estonian cybersecurity firm. Yet there is plenty of the U.S. can draw from Estonia's model. Ms. Kaldoran says, Estonia learned three key lessons from 2007 that can be applied to countries of any size, putting the topic high on the political agenda, establishing a clear division of responsibilities, and creating a multi stakeholder model of security that involves not only the government, but also the private sector, academia, and civil society. The U.S. has taken important steps in this direction, classifying election systems as critical infrastructure, improving coordination between various government agencies, and better supporting state and local election officials. But it has no overarching national strategy to counter foreign influence, despite various agencies tackling different aspects of the issue, according to a 2019 report by the Homeland Security Advisory Council. Mr. Schaefer notes that there is no strategic communications groups like the one Mr. Compass is part of, and that's a huge problem. Still, Estonia is proof that such alertness can come from the people themselves. As a youth growing up in Soviet times, Mr. Padar, like many other young people, was influenced by the ubiquitous propaganda designed to produce good Soviet citizens. He yearned to become a soldier and defend the great homeland. But in high school, he started thinking more for himself and found another way to serve, first as a police officer and now as a commander of the Cyber Defense League. In the event of a crisis, not only will his volunteers spring into action as Minutemen, but other techies in Estopia's private sector will likely join in as well, says Mr. Sakov. I'm more than certain that they will basically call the friends and say, how can I help? And that was the cover story. This week it was entitled, Estonia's Cyber Warriors: How the Tiny Baltic State Has Become a Model in Foiling Russian Hacking and Disinformation. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Points of Progress. This is a map of the world spanning two pages with points marked and a paragraph or two for each point. Number one, California. Alyssa Nacken became the first full-time female coach in Major League Baseball, after being hired as an assistant by the San Francisco Giants in January. A former college softball player, Ms. Nacken will help coordinate health and wellness programming while traveling with the team. Simply, I think she's going to be a great coach, said manager Gabe Kapler. Merit and the ability to be a great coach trumps all. Ms. Nacken's hire follows the New York Yankees' November hiring of Rachel Balkovic as a hitting coach for their minor league team, making her the first full-time female hitting coach hired in professional baseball. And that was from ESPN. Number two, Norway. Norway's bike-friendly capital of Oslo is on the brink of achieving a safe and equitable transit system goal after recording zero pedestrian or cyclist deaths in 2019. The reduction, down from 5 deaths in 2018, is largely a result of a 2015 plan to reduce the number of cars on the road and promote cycling, foot traffic, and public transit in Oslo's car-free city center, advocates say. The country as a whole already has some of the safest roads in the world, making its nearly 50% reduction in traffic fatalities between 2010 and 2017 more impressive, according to the International Transport Forum's 2019 Road Safety Report. And that was from Smart Cities Dive. Number three, Florida. Florida's Department of Environmental Protection will acquire 20,000 acres of wetlands in the Everglades to protect it after a court ruled the former owner, a real estate firm, could drill for oil on the land. Announced in a press release from Republican Governor Ron DeSantis's office, the wetland acquisition is said to be the largest in a decade and could help protect more than 60 endangered and threatened species. Environmental groups praised the decision by Governor DeSantis, who has made preserving the Everglades one of his top environmental priorities since announcing a four-year, $2.5 billion spending plan to preserve the ecosystem in 2019. The purchase comes as some Republican governors in coastal states begin to resist efforts by the White House to loosen regulations on offshore drilling. And that was from CNN. Number four, Africa. Nigeria marked 3 years without a polio case, meaning Africa could be declared polio-free as early as this year. The progress follows what Dr. Matshidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, called a monumental effort of health workers across Nigeria, which in 2012 had 200 reported cases of the disease. We are confident that soon we will be trumpeting the certification that countries have, once and for all, kicked polio out of Africa, says Dr. Moeti. If the continent is indeed declared polio-free, then Pakistan and Afghanistan will be the last major countries where the disease is endemic. That was from The Guardian. Number 5, China. China is banning plastic bags in all major cities by the end of this year and in all cities and towns by the end of 2022, according to a new policy from the National Development and Reform Commission and the Ministry of Ecology and Environment. The ban comes as China, perhaps the largest producer of plastic waste in the world, attempts to significantly reduce its reliance on single-use plastics. Other items, such as plastic straws, will also be phased out in the restaurant industry, which faces a 5-year deadline to reduce its plastic use by 30%. Fresh produce markets, meanwhile, will be exempt from the bans until 2025. And that was from Reuters. And lastly, worldwide. New findings from researchers at the University of Washington contradict the popular belief that fisheries around the world are declining. Around half the fish caught worldwide, the report says, come from stocks that are monitored and increasing in abundance. Adding to a decade of work and international cooperation, the research project identifies effective fishery management as the most important tool in maintaining healthy fish stocks, even as large gaps in the data remain. There is a narrative that fish stocks are declining around the world, that fisheries management is failing, and we need new solutions. And it's totally wrong, says lead author Ray Hilborn, a professor at the University of Washington School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. And that was from the University of Washington. And all that was compiled by Noah Robertson, who is a correspondent. And that was Points of Progress. And now for Science and Nature in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article, and I will read it. It's entitled, Trump Takes on 50 Years of Environmental Law. This is written by Amanda Paulson and Timmy Broderick, both staff writers. There's a paragraph here that says why we wrote this. Conservatives see unnecessary red tape that slows progress and costs American jobs. Liberals see transparency that protects the land, water, and air. Either way, the Trump administration is making a concerted effort to roll back environmental oversight. From Boulder, Colorado and Washington, it was 1970. Congress was wrestling with whether to give the right-of-way necessary to build an 800-mile oil pipeline across Alaska when a district judge blocked the project, using a brand-new law requiring federal agencies to consider the environmental effect of projects. The Interior Department was stunned, recalled William Riley, a staff member in the Nixon administration at the time, and later Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, administrator. The law's environmental impact statements, common today, were novel at the time. Even the authors of the statute didn't anticipate that it could be used to hold up a major project like that, he says. Now, 50 years later, that law, the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, is under attack. The Trump administration last month proposed reforms to the act that would significantly reduce its scope. It's the latest move in an unprecedented effort to roll back not only Obama-era regulations, but also some of the bedrock laws that have shaped federal environmental policy since the 1970s. It's not unique in being a pushback against regulation or even in favoring the energy industry, but it's unique in just how relentless it has been, says Daniel Farber, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley. There have been at least 50 significant environmental regulations President Donald Trump has targeted, Professor Farber notes. They're leaving no stone unturned. For President Trump, it's a pendulum swing that is long overdue. The United States will not be able to compete and prosper in the 21st century if we continue to allow a broken and outdated bureaucratic system hold us back from building what we need. The roads, the airports, the schools, everything, he said last month in proposing changes to NEPA. Environmental consideration versus delay. Critics of the Act, who often complain about lengthy environmental reviews and the impact statements required for major projects, welcome the proposal. It would not only impose new deadlines on such studies, but would also narrow the range of what could be considered. This is not about anti-regulation, says Marty Durbin, president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Global Energy Institute. It's about having a smart process in place and a certain process in place so that we can get decisions that will unlock the investment necessary to get these projects built as critical infrastructure. If there's uncertainty about when a project will be approved, it's harder to attract investors, he adds. But others note that NEPA has played a critical role simply by ensuring that the environment gets consideration. It's something that says, consider, reflect. Is this something you want to do? Is this the best way to do it? Are there any other ways you could do it? Says Mr. Riley, the former EPA administrator. In the case of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, it took more than 4 years of wrangling, an Arab oil embargo, and a special act of Congress before the permits were approved. But Mr. Riley recalls the chairman of the oil company in charge telling him that the final project was more robust and sound as a result of the environmental review process. This year marks the 50th anniversary of several major environmental landmarks, notes Douglas Brinkley, a history professor at Rice University, NEPA, the first Earth Day, and the creation of the EPA. Those actions, along with other major 1970s legislation like the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act, also hardened an anti-regulatory mindset among many conservatives that has continued to grow. Critics of the laws see them as burdensome, red tape that can hold back development and economic growth, and Ronald Reagan was the first president to attempt significant rollbacks. But Mr. Trump, who has had his own battles with environmental reviews as a developer, is trying harder than any previous president to truly dismantle that 1970s-era policy, says Professor Brinkley. A 2016 Congressional Research Service report says critics overstate the NEPA permitting process's effect on project delays. Insufficient data, lack of funds, and state and local issues are far more likely culprits. Some projects languish in permit purgatory for up to a decade, but the vast majority do not. The average length of time for a full environmental impact statement takes 4.5 years, according to the Council on Environmental Quality. Furthermore, only 1% of projects within the NEPA umbrella complete an EIS, according to a 2014 Government Accountability Office report. Many people want a speedier process, acknowledge Mr. Riley and others, and if that were the administration's sole objective, the proposed changes would be less controversial. But by narrowing the range of projects that require environmental review and no longer requiring consideration of a project's cumulative effects, which under President Barack Obama were expanded to include long-term climate change effects, the administration is targeting the backbone of U.S. environmental policy. Beyond Obama-era regulations. Early deregulation efforts of the Trump administration targeted Obama-era rules. The Clean Water Rule that defined what waters are subject to federal water protection, the Clean Power Plan designed to regulate carbon dioxide pollution, and methane rules regulating the release of a potent greenhouse gas. One of Mr. Trump's most controversial actions, the legality of which is still being tested in the courts, has been an attempted reduction of two national monument designations in Utah. There is also evidence of a significant shift towards less enforcement of regulations and policies that remain on the books. Whittling away the government's regulatory structures has always been part of Mr. Trump's agenda, but his dismantling of the EPA is unique, says Caitlin McCoy, a fellow in the Environmental and Energy Law Program at Harvard Law School, who tracks such changes. Changing NEPA is the latest sign that the administration aims to undermine the statutory foundations of the EPA. They're trying to take away the very things that the agency relies on to do its job, she says. With other agencies, it's similar. Like, yes, we're relaxing some of these tax rates, but it's not like we're trying to keep the IRS from doing audits. It's not clear how successful the administration will be. For at least some of these regulations, the appeals will not hold up in court, says Professor Farber. It's not clear in the case of NEPA, for instance, whether Mr. Trump has the power to drastically reinterpret a major law enacted by Congress. But for Mr. Trump, the payoff politically, showing his determination to undo environmental regulations that many view as overly burdensome, may be enough. Trump is doing overreach and getting his comeuppance in the courts, says Professor Brinkley, but it looks good to his supporters in 2020. And that was an article in the Science and Nature section entitled, Trump Takes on 50 Years of Environmental Law. And here we are in the Home Forums section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. As usual, there are two articles, and I will read both of them. The first one is entitled, Making My Peace with the Desert and a Mule. To many, the desert spring where my wife and I live is remote and isolated, but to others, it is a center or can become one. This is written by Jeff Muse. Unloading the groceries last night beneath the luminescent spiral of the Milky Way, its horizon-wide arc fading into sky glow, suburbs, casinos, 3,000-room hotels, I heard Red kicking his trough, begging. I've come to know that sound, that rhythm, a slow, steady cadence in the high desert darkness every time my headlights swing through the corral and then I step from my car door to the hatchback. Boom, boom. I've come to know it, to cherish it. I know now that a retired Grand Canyon mule, though lanky and rickety and 3 decades old, thinks he's in charge of the place. And he is, really. He's in charge of my date with my wife this morning. Carhartts and work gloves, old uniform boots, we'll shovel manure and we'll walk the boys. Paula and I have lived at Pipe Spring National Monument in Arizona for nearly 2 years. It's federal property, 40 acres, a postage stamp of sagebrush and juniper, apples, peaches, plums. It's surrounded by the 120,000-acre reservation of the Kaibab Band of Paiutes, their ancestral homeland. And as the monument's website explains, generations of American Indians, Mormon ranchers, plants, animals, and many others have depended on the life-giving water, just as we now depend on it to drink, bathe, wash our clothes. We depend on decades-old snowmelt trickling through sandstone. But honestly, until Paula applied to be the interpretive manager of the site, a position requiring year-round residence in a small, dust-covered house, a position she took to get back into the National Park Service after 4 years with another agency, I hadn't known about Pipe Spring. Hadn't even heard of it. Hadn't lived with rattlesnakes in the woodpile either. Hadn't watched a black widow spider up close, chased a jackrabbit, or hiked a trail from the back door, up a cliff face, and then set my hand in a dinosaur's track. A theropod, according to my field guide. A carnivore. It walked this ground 180 million years ago. This is all my way of saying that life along the Arizona Strip has surprised us. The affection we feel, the welcome. Yet we cannot stay. We know this. The remoteness and the isolation are unsustainable. This summer, I'm home only on my days off from Zion, about a 2-hour drive given Springdale's tourist crowds. Stop for groceries, and it's 3. And in those hours, I skirt the geology of the Grand Staircase, the pink cliffs, gray, white, vermilion. My mind veers to what-ifs. What if I never have a year-round job again? What if the stock market tanks? What if the physical demands of the commuting grow to be too much? This life is beautiful, but exhausting. None of that matters this morning. Red's waiting. The horse, Rowdy. The steers, the chickens, the ducks. Our cupboard's full. We've got a date. Still, I'm thinking about our native neighbors, how they exist here, how they endure. It is not remote, they might say. The place is our center. We are of it. I should head inside to the orchard. From there, it's just a few steps to the mule. Apples, Paula says. He loves apples. And that was Making My Peace with the Desert and a Mule. To many, the desert spring where my wife and I live is remote and isolated. but to others, it is a center or can become one. The next article in the Home Forum section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly is the In a Word column by Melissa Moore. This week it's entitled, A Lighter Side of Quid Pro Quo. And she writes, one Latin phrase has come up over and over in the past year, quid pro quo. It defines the central question of President Donald Trump's dealings with Ukraine. Did he make military funding contingent on an investigation into Joe Biden and his family? This is a language column, so we won't go into the politics. Instead, let's talk about the many words and phrases like quid pro quo that English has acquired from its multifarious Latin pronouns quis and qui. I will warn you here, I do not speak Latin too well. These pronouns are often indistinguishable in Latin and mean more or less the same thing: who, what, which, and someone, something. Quis is clearly visible in a Roman satirist Juvenal's famous question, quis custodiet ipsos custodes, or who will guard the guards themselves? In English, this phrase is often used to highlight the dangers of corruption among the powerful. They watch us. Who watches them? But Latin nouns and pronouns decline, changing shape and depending on the role they play in the sentence. Quid pro quo itself is just two different forms of quis. Its neuter nominative form, quid, plus its ablative form, quo. The phrase means something for something. Quomodo is the manner, the means, as in these lines from Henry Fielding's classic Tom Jones from 1749. Northerton was desirous of departing, and nothing remained for him but to contrive the quo modo. The feminine form is qua, which gives us the sine qua non, the without which not, or better translated, the essential, indispensable. In the dative case, used to indicate the recipient of the thing or action, quis becomes qui, C-U-I. As in cui bono, the question asked in hundreds of courtrooms in detective novels, means to whom for a benefit, or more elegantly, who profits. The genitive plural contributed quorum, of whom, which means the number of officers or members of a body that, when duly assembled, is legally competent to transact business. In English, quid is related both to the deepest mysteries of being and to the glibest trivialities. From the 17th century, quid has meant that which a thing is, its essence. When a character in a 19th century play says, "My age has seen the quid of things," he is talking about the wisdom he has gained as he has grown older. But quid also produced quiddity, which often means a trifling point, quibble, to make frivolous objections, and quip, a cutting or witty remark. When mathematicians finish a proof, they can employ another qui relative, quod erat demonstrandum, that which was to be demonstrated. This indicates they believe they have proved the problem satisfactorily. So, QED, or as my high school geometry teacher translated it, quit. Enough done. Well, that was the In a Word column by Melissa Moore, and this week it was entitled, A Lighter Side of Quid Pro Quo. And finally, we get to the Monitor's View. These are articles written by the editorial staff. There are two of them, and I will read both. The first one is entitled, The Fear Factor in China's Epidemic. Much of the world is watching China closely to see if it can contain a virus that has spread to other countries. Its government has already quarantined nearly 50 million people in 16 cities and rushed to build new hospitals. Yet what should be watched just as closely is how much China has learned about containing public fear. Since the country's last major virus outbreak in 2002 and 2003, Chinese officials have come a long way in their capacity for calming. International health officials often talk of the need to battle two epidemics at once, an epidemic of disease and an epidemic of fear. With social media able to spread both falsehoods and genuine warnings, fear can propagate even faster than a disease. In fact, unnecessary panic can do its own kind of damage. It can break community ties, increase distrust of leaders, create false narratives of victimization, or lead to temporary panic in the global economy. Once amplified, fear can prevent people from hearing accurate information during a crisis. To avoid such damage, Chinese officials have tried to be more transparent and precise in their daily briefings about what they know of this outbreak and what is being done. They have allowed the official news media to be relatively free of normal censorship. And to regain public trust after making mistakes early on, some officials have apologized. The mayor of Wuhan, the city that is ground zero for the outbreak, offered to resign as long as it is conducive to the control of the disease and to the people's lives and safety. In addition, the World Health Organization held off hitting its own panic button and declaring a global emergency in the first weeks of the outbreak. It, too, has learned how to better balance issuing alerts about real danger against the possibility of provoking undue alarm. Fear during an epidemic needs its own kind of vaccines. And what are those? A report last year from an independent panel set up by the World Health Organization and the World Bank recommended a number of non-medical ways that officials can be ready for before an epidemic to deal with the fear factor. In short, the 15-member panel stated, long-term, sustained community engagement is crucial for detecting outbreaks early, controlling amplification and spread, ensuring trust and social cohesion, and fostering effective responses. In other words, avoiding a health panic requires a community to have a reservoir of unity, compassion, and openness. These are some of the traits for resiliency and are needed as medical supplies and health workers. They help keep caution from escalating into fear. And when a health crisis is over, they also help heal any broken bonds of community. And that was the fear factor in China's epidemic. And the second one is why 2020 may be a year of giving. Politics in the U.S. is so intense that spending on political ads for the 2020 elections could reach $20 billion. That would be a big jump from the $16 billion 4 years ago. More people are willing to give more money for public causes. At the same time, private giving to nonprofit groups may also see a banner year. In 2019, charitable giving reached an estimated $430 billion, up slightly from the year before, despite a 2017 tax law that reduces taxpayer incentives to itemize donations. In both types of giving, whether for advocacy on a national issue or for action to solve a local problem, the motive is often a strong belief in how to shape society. Political donors, of course, may be trying to rig public policy with their personal benefit or for their personal benefit, but the line between selfless and selfish giving is often blurred. The larger picture is one of greater civic engagement, at least measured by donations. Groups that rely on private giving are concerned that Americans have a limit on their generosity. They warn of a competition for dollars between charities and politicians. Or they worry about the rising cost to run an ad asking for money. Yet the limitation is not in the amount of discretionary money in people's bank accounts. It is in the vision of those asking for the money. A worthy cause can alter a person's spending priorities. Giving to a cause can transform both the donor and the recipient. It incites others to give. It helps people align their values for common purposes. For many, giving is merely a reflection of the good given to them. The meaning of given has also expanded to include ethical investing or investing in for-profit businesses with social goals, such as selling goods made of recycled material. As trust in traditional institutions declines, young people are inventing new ways to help others. They seek giving that is egalitarian and results guaranteed. The biggest result of giving is a more compassionate society. Giving helps build community, whether it is a donation to a political campaign or a homeless shelter. Unlike the money itself, the effects can be immeasurable. And that was why 2020 may be a year of giving. Well, as usual, I have a few minutes left, so I'll read from the Overheard column. It's actually a section. Overheard, it is quotes and then an explanation of that quote. The first one, your deal of the century is the opportunity of the century. That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to President Donald Trump in a joint appearance at the White House on January 28th regarding the 181-page Middle East peace plan released by the Trump administration. The plan outlines a two-state solution under conditions that Palestinians immediately rejected. Mr. Trump said his proposals include the opportunity for Palestinians to achieve an independent state of their very own and receive substantial U.S. aid, but Jerusalem would remain the undivided capital of Israel and existing Jewish settlements in the West Bank might stay. The next one is, we will not kneel and we will not surrender. That was from the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, at a January 28th news conference after Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu announced their Middle East peace plan. Palestinian leaders have rejected the plan even before the January 28th announcement, citing U.S. bias towards Israel. But on the day of the Trump-Netanyahu conference, Mr. Abbas added, after the nonsense that we heard today, we say 1,000 no's to the deal of the century. Protests against the plan broke out across the Gaza Strip. And lastly, I'm not a militant of the FARC anymore. I don't want to be a militant of any party. I want to be a militant of my people. That was Mayor Guillermo Torres, one of the first ex-FARC combatants to win an election by popular vote, about taking office in Turbaco, Colombia, even as public faith in the 2016 peace agreement remains shaky. During his campaign, Mr. Torres distanced himself from the guerrilla's reputation by running under the leftist Colombia Humana Party rather than the FARC Party, and claiming that all he did during the country's bloody civil war was play music at rebel events. Still, he received death threats and now travels with a bodyguard. And that was three quotes and their explanation from the Overheard column. And did you know that Kobe Bryant was named the Pro Basketball All-Star 18 times during his 20-year career? Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.